and we're going to start with a lesson, and I know you have a lot to share. Okay, here we go. And Paige, we're at the Messiah in the Old Testament class on Tuesday morning, Scottsdale Bible Women's Bible Study. It's week 5. Can you believe it's week 5? We're halfway through. At the end of this class, we're halfway through. And we're calling it Conquest. Conquest. And it is October 8th, 2019. Okay. So, how were your circumstances this week? Remember Sarah had mentioned circumstances, it's what goes around us, and we stand firm in the middle. I really love that. So just take note of your circumstances and how you're responding, how you are standing and clinging to Jesus. Now, some of you asked last week about the stones being set up in the midst of the Jordan River. Remember we talked about that? After the 12 memorial stones were brought to Gilgal, their camp where they were lodging. This is not on your handout, but turn to Joshua 4, verses 3 in your Bible, 3:8-9. Joshua 4, 3, then 8-9. And 3 says, take for yourselves 12 stones from here, out of the midst of the Jordan, from the place where the priest's feet stood firm. You shall carry them over with you and leave them in the lodging place where you lodge tonight. Again, it's 3, verses 8 to 9. The children of Israel took up 12 stones from the midst of the Jordan, as the Lord had spoken to Joshua, according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, and carried them over with them to the place where they lodged and laid them down there. Verse 9 says, then Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant stood, and they are there to this day. So there's the distinction between the stones that were taken to the camping place, the lodging place, Gilgal, and the 12 stones that were set up in the midst of the Jordan. I agree, though, that it's confusing when you first read it, and when you read it a second time and a third time. So, but I just wanted to mention that. We are in Joshua still, and we're in the Messiah in the Old Testament. How does this all speak to the Messiah in the Old Testament? In many places in the Old Testament, we have direct prophecies. Here we have more of a foreshadowing. And we've seen foreshadowings in the Torah when we went through the first 5 books of Moses in the last semester. But Joshua's Hebrew name is what? Yeshua, right. And Joshua sent the 2 spies, Jewish spies, to speak to the Gentile Rahab. That's a biblical principle. God was going to use the Jews to be a light, an instrument of blessing to the world. And he did just so with those 2 spies. And then we had that 10th day when we talked about the Jewish people having crossed over, crossed the Jordan River, the dry Jordan River, and it was on the 10th day of the first month of the religious calendar, and we talked about that being the day called Lamb Selection Day during Passover week that we read about in the book of Exodus. So they have already gone through that in the book of Joshua. So we're in Joshua 5 and 6 today, so we're going to look at Joshua 4 again for context. And it's 19 to 24. It's at the top of your handout. And it says, now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month and camped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up in Gilgal. Then he spoke to the children of Israel, saying, when your children ask their fathers, I love that, when your children ask their fathers, they're going to do that. In time to come, saying, what are these stones? Then you shall let your children know, saying, Israel crossed over this Jordan on dry land. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we crossed over. Then, verse 24, then that all the peoples, we crossed over, he dried up the Red Sea, we crossed on dry ground in the Jordan, that all the peoples of the earth may know the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. So why did God work these miracles at the Red Sea and at the Jordan River?
For his glory.
For his glory. And some might say for passage for the children of Israel, and it was indeed. But bottom line, it's always for God's glory. So the biblical principle in Scripture is that God desires to make himself known to the world. We need to latch on to that. So why is that biblical principle? Why does God want to make himself known in the world? He wants to have a relationship, and he wants to be worshipped. Just think of creation as he created the world out of nothing, and how his plan for creation with the tree of life in the Garden of Eden, and then sin came into the world. Of course, that wasn't a surprise to God that sin entered the world, but his plan is for restoration. And yes, and he wants to live with us. And Habakkuk 2:14 says that the entire earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of God. That will happen. Man, that doesn't look like it's going to happen nowadays when we get up and hear this, that, and the other thing. So, but it is going to happen. What is that application for us in that biblical principle? Yes, just to make him known. To be still and know that he is God, to marvel at him. So many times, application should be, wow, look at our God, look at our great God, what he has done, what he is doing, how we can worship him, and how we can anticipate what he is going to continue to do. So again, that all the peoples of the earth may know the hand of the Lord, his works, his wonders, that he is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. And so we read, moving from Joshua 4 to Joshua 1. So it was when all the kings of the Amorites who were on the west side of the Jordan, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan from before the children of Israel until we had crossed over, that their heart melted. Their heart melted. What does that mean? What have you observed about this passage? I heard you guys talking about it. But just general observations. What are some general observations about that? Verse 1, I said passage, just verse 1. Hey, word travels fast, doesn't it? Without the technology that we have today, that all the people, all the kings of the Amorites on the west side of the Jordan, and then where were the other ones? By the sea. What sea are they talking about? The Mediterranean Sea. Look at your map. Sarah Bamford had given us this map. Isn't it great? And I will tell you that, and I don't know her resource. But we can ask her next week or the week after, because you guys are without Sarah. Nancy and Sandy are leading, right, for 2 weeks? Oh, okay. You're facilitating, same thing. But there's some debate about where Mount Sinai is. I just want to make mention of that. Do you see where Mount Sinai is on your map? It's right in the center, but right in the at the bottom. And it says Horeb, that's another name for Mount Sinai. There is some debate about that. I'm not going to go into that now, maybe another time. Okay, so, but look at where the sea is, the Mediterranean Sea, the Great Sea, in relation to where they crossed by Jericho. That's a distance in those days. And the people by the Mediterranean Sea heard. So the Phoenicians were on the seacoast. They were famous as traders and as sailors. And then you have the cities of Tyre and Sidon, and you don't even see them on the map. They are way north of where it says Nazareth, okay? And actually where Tyre and Sidon were, they are today, well, where they were is now Lebanon. So just envision that in your mind. Some near Jericho saw the waters heaped up for miles. And remember, we said that God might have heaped up those waters 27 miles beyond where they were crossing at the Jordan because of the locations that are mentioned in that scripture. And we talked too about how 2 million plus people might have gone across the Jordan hurriedly. They went in haste. They crossed in a day, and they might have walked hundreds and thousands abreast across the dry riverbed. And how are we getting 2 million plus people? Well, if you go to the census that's taken, there are two censuses, no, censi, whatever, census taken in the book of Numbers. One is Numbers 1:46, the other one is Numbers 26:51. And it didn't change much. Remember, the first generation died in the wilderness. God had said that you disobeyed me, you went against me, your carcasses are going to be scattered in the wilderness. Okay? And we had talked about that before. But in Numbers 26:51, the second census, there were 601,730 men of military age. 601,730. That's a lot of men. You take into consideration wives, you take into consideration kids, and my husband believes it's 2.4 million, but I wasn't following him when he said that. Sorry, Bobby, if you're listening, but he's not listening. I feel better saying 2 million plus. We'll leave it at that. But that's how many came across. Now, others from this passage in Joshua 5:1, this verse, others received the word about what had been transpiring at the Jordan supernaturally, and about God's feet, tremendous feet, not F-E-E-T, F-E-A-T, his wonders. They had already heard about the Red Sea. Rahab told the two spies about. We heard what God did at the Red Sea. Israel had been given great victories by God and provided their food and their water. And God is the one who caused their garments not to wear out or their shoes. And some people say, well, that's a little like mundane. But just think, if you were crossing across the desert, would you think that was mundane? Your sandals and your clothes just being, you know, like you took it off the rack from whatever store you go to when you ended at the place, when you got to your destination. So, but their heart melted. The question on your handout is, what does that mean? Their heart melted. Singular, their heart melted. What'd you come up with? They were all afraid, but why? Why? It's interesting that its heart melted. Yeah, check out, write out in your handout, Deuteronomy 2:25. Okay, Deuteronomy 2:25. And this was said to the children of Israel before the crossing of the Jordan, before they got to the land of promise. And God says to them in 25th verse of chapter 2 in Deuteronomy, "This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you upon the nations under the whole heaven, who shall hear the report of you and shall tremble and be in anguish because of you." So I also put in my margin groupthink, and that has a negative connotation today, but some of you might follow me with that groupthink. The same impact on the entire population. Of course, this is talking about the kings, but you know, as go the leaders, so go the people. As the kings are in fear, that would strike fear into the population as well. The Hebrew word for melted means dissolved, wasted away, became faint, grew fearful. And actually, the second half of Joshua 5:1 explains what they were feeling. It says, "And there was no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel." The people of the land of Canaan had lost confidence. And why had they lost confidence? Guess who were they were depending on? Their gods. Their gods who were idols. And who were the Jewish people depending on as they're trekking across the wilderness and going across the Jordan? God. God. And they're learning more and more through this experience how to trust God. Isn't that exciting? We don't want to go through those times that are difficult, but don't we learn to trust him more? So they're on the other side of the Jordan. They're at their lodging place, and what a perfect time to attack Jericho, wouldn't it be? And remember the tribes of Gad and, Asher, Reuben, Gad, and the half of the tribe of Manasseh had passed over with them, 40,000 strong, because they were ready to fight with their tribesmen against what was going to happen in Jericho. But because it was the perfect, here's where we go here, because it was the perfect time to fight, what happened? Verse 2, Joshua 5. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, "You know, Joshua, I want you to make flint knives for yourselves." You know what flint knives are? Yes, they're stones. They're made from sharp stones. "And circumcise the sons of Israel," again, the second time. That's verbatim from verse 2, the second time. And Joshua's reply was, "Really, God?" No, he obeyed. He obeyed. And we see what happens. There's that obedience that we see graphically demonstrated thus far. Haven't we seen obedience in this whole account of coming to the Jordan on the east side and then crossing over? And they're obeying God, who is worthy of all our praise and devotion and obedience. But then you might wonder why it says, "Circumcise the sons of Israel again the second time."
Right.
Yeah. Did you wonder about that?
Yeah.
Because circumcision is physical, right? I mean, he's taking a knife. That's pretty physical. We know what he's going to do. Flint knives aren't figurative language here. So let's look at verses 3 to 7 in Joshua 5. So Joshua made flint knives, sharp stones, for himself, and circumcised the sons of Israel at the Hill of the Foreskins. I'm thinking it was called the Hill of the Foreskins afterwards. And this is the reason. I mean, there wasn't a predetermined place.
It took a while to get past that one.
Yeah. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. Verse 5 underscored, "For all the people who came out of Egypt had been circumcised." So in other words, they were 430 years. The Jews were 430 years in Egypt. 400 of those years there was affliction. I had read a resource that said they weren't circumcised in Egypt because only the hierarchy in Egypt were circumcised. Because, you know, circumcision was done in other Middle Eastern areas. Not all. Remember, Goliath was called an uncircumcised person. So the Phoenicians, the Philistines weren't circumcised. But I do believe that the Jewish people were circumcised in Egypt, because it says that the people who came out had been circumcised. Now, if they were 431 years old at that time, but they weren't, you get what I'm saying? They could have been circumcised in the land of Canaan and then gone to Egypt. But anyway, I digress. So they had been circumcised. But then verse 5 says, "But all the people born in the wilderness on the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. For the children of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness till all the people who were men of war," and in that census that was taken, and men of war would be those who were 20 years old and upward. And the first census registered 603,550 men of war. And they came out of Egypt, the first generation. They were consumed because they did not obey the voice of the Lord. And if you drop down, and I think you can only drop down, because I don't think I included all these other verses that I put on my notes, but verse 7 says that, "Then Joshua circumcised their sons, whom he had raised up in their place, for they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way." All right. And you know, in the Bible talks about children being circumcised at 8 days, male Hebrew children, 8 days. Okay, and that's in Genesis 17. So speaking of Genesis 17, that's where it talks about circumcision as a sign for what? Abrahamic covenant. So is that significant? Why would it be significant? I'm actually on page 2 of your handout. Why would that sign be significant? Think of this. I mean, circumcision is a physical procedure, right? And it represented the sanctifying, the consecrating of life, because circumcision cuts away the male part of the male organ by which life is reproduced. Okay? And in scripture, when you cut away flesh, when we read about cutting away flesh, we're going to read a verse in Colossians in a bit, but cutting away the flesh, is the flesh a good thing to be walking in as believers? No. So here's a foreshadowing of that. And circumcision was really, when you think of it, a powerful act of consecrating yourself to God. Not comfortable, right? But consecrating to God. It was stepping out, and your handout says this, in obedience and truly identifying as one of God's, the Lord's people. Now, why was circumcision not carried out in the 40 years in the wilderness? Had you thought about that? I've thought about a lot of things about what was going on in the wilderness, and I find myself, even this morning as I was going over these notes, still pouring through Numbers. I don't think I've ever been in Numbers this much as in this study, and it's great, and it's giving me more of an understanding, but I know I have to go back to it again and again. But I looked up, why wasn't circumcision, exercised, done in the wilderness? And do you know that Moses didn't circumcise one of his sons? We know Gershom and Eleazar, I think the other one was named. It doesn't say who, it says one of his sons Moses didn't circumcise. We're told that, you might want to read at this in study time, Exodus 4. And the Lord met him on the way. Moses was going back to Egypt after he had been in Midian and he was taking his wife Zipporah, and their two sons, and the Lord met him. I think it's in verse 24, of Exodus 4. Lord met him on the way to kill him, because he hadn't obeyed that command to circumcise. So who circumcised the son? Zipporah did, and she had some odd things to say to Moses, and there's conjecture about that. But anyway, I did want to share that with you about Moses. But there were two resources that I read, and I'm going to read these two comments to you and see what you think. All right, I'm not even going to give expression to them until after. Unger's Dictionary said, this neglect, about neglecting to circumcise in the desert, is most satisfactorily explained as follows. The nation, while bearing the punishment of disobedience in its wanderings, was regarded as under temporary rejection by God and was therefore prohibited from using the sign of the covenant. Okay, let me fast forward to what John Calvin said. Calvin leads us to connect the suspension of circumcision, stopping the circumcision in the desert, with the punishment of the Israelites and with the sentence that doomed them to wander 40 years in the wilderness. When the worship of the golden calf took place, the nation was rejected. What do you think about that comment?
I'm just wondering, not necessarily it's important what I think.
Yes, it is, and I got to give you the microphone.
I just thought that they weren't circumcised because they were disobedient to God. Mm-hmm. They just were wandering, not wandering, but because they worshipped idols, mm-hmm, and were disobedient, mm-hmm, they just kind of gave up that step. But maybe.
But being circumcised. Okay, that's good to know what we're thinking.
But
No. This is, you're thinking through it, okay? Because we want to think through scripture, Jenny.
Could it be because circumcision was a sign that they were a separate people,
When they were among other people.
Yeah.
When they were in the desert, they were already separated from other people, and it was not needed until they went to Canaan.
Anyone else? Is that Sally? How are you? Linda.
Well, I was reading that there were tons of other people, that a multitude went out with them. So they were mixed in the desert with all kinds of non-believers. And, you know, if you were living anywhere near there, you would have known those wild people were roaming around in the desert all those years.
Bedouins, the nomadic people.
Or even people in the land they were going to conquer. They must have known they were out there. It must have just bothered them they were even there.
Being separate people.
Separated to God. They just weren't the only people out there in the wilderness.
Okay. Good, this is good.
Iron sharpens iron. Anything else, Cheryl?
Was it done? I really don't know, but was it done for cleanliness also?
Yeah, people say that.
Was that a part of it or not?
Yeah, it was done for cleanliness, okay. But it was done for the bottom reason, no pun intended, is that the... The male organ was cut because that would give life. And let's face it, that's huge for original sin purposes. When we think of original sin, we're born in sin. It's interesting that many Jewish people don't believe that we're born in sin. I won't go there. But when I wrote this down on my notes, I have underscore and I have question marks about this rejection part. If God rejected the children of Israel, why did he meet again? And this is not in your handout, so if you want to take notes, if you want to, why did he meet again with Moses and give Moses the new tablets of the law after about 3,000 were killed for worshiping the golden calf? And remember, God, when there was that idol worship, God punished them. There were not only about 3,000 people killed for worshiping the golden calf. 1 Corinthians 10:8 says, Exodus 32 says there was a plague against many of them. You know how many? 23,000. 23,000 died from that. So God, he has to take sin, matters of sin, into his own hands. He has to come against sin because he is holy. So regarding then giving Moses the Ten Commandments again, he met with Moses on Mount Sinai. That's a beautiful picture of God's grace in the midst of sin raging. And then after the Golden Calf episode, why do we see such a beautiful picture of the people's repentance? Read Exodus 33. It's just an amazing passage, especially Exodus 33, 1 through 11, and then verse 14, and how the people had a heart to meet with God as Moses met with God in his tent that he pitched outside the camp, not the tabernacle tent, but Moses' personal tent. So, and why did God reinstate the instructions for the building of the tabernacle with all the furnishings? If they had been rejected, why would that have happened? Why would God say in Deuteronomy 2:25 that I'm putting the dread and fear of you upon the nations? If they were rejected, people, he would say, have at it, guys, I'm finished. Wendy?
Also the manna every day.
Yes! He was feeding them, and the water, definitely, and the shoes and the garments, most definitely. In fact, that's what I've written. If God had rejected the children of Israel, there wouldn't be those provisions. And God fought for them. Jot down Exodus 17, 8 through 13, how God fought for them when they went against the Amalekites. And then, what about Balaam? You're familiar with Balaam, right? The Jewish people had already come to the east side, the plains of Moab, the east side of the Jordan. They were getting ready to, they camped there for a while before they camped for 3 days right beyond the east side of the Jordan and watched the raging sea. But Numbers 22:1, great passage to write down. Numbers 22:1 says, "Then the children of Israel moved and camped in the plains of Moab on the side of the Jordan across from Jericho." Now Balak, he was the king of Moab. He had seen all that Israel had done to certain tribes. And he hired a prophet who was for hire, a false prophet, and we know him as Balaam. And he wanted Balaam to do what? To curse Israel, okay? And the Lord intersected, the angel of the Lord, pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus, intersected Balaam on his donkey. And Numbers 22:32 says, "Behold," this is the angel of the Lord talking, "Behold, I have come out to stand against you because your way is perverse before me." I don't want Israel cursed, he's saying. Your way is perverse. You're going to curse them? That's no way. It's perverse before me. Numbers 24:1-5. Amazing verse. The first verse here. "Now when Balaam saw," finally, because, I mean, he was really fighting against Balak and then God and himself. It says, "Now when Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel." So right in the middle of rejection, if you're going to go the way of, well, God rejected Israel in the wilderness, when Balaam realized that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, that's an enormous verse. That's one that I have used so many times. He did not go, as at other times, to seek to use sorcery. It says in verse 2, "Balaam raised his eyes and saw Israel encamped according to their tribes, and the Spirit of God came upon him." And then he gave oracles, he gave utterances. And he says in his utterances, and this is from God, Balaam was a false prophet. In fact, in Joshua we read in later chapters that he was killed by the Israelites. But he did say, "How lovely are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel." God wanted him to say that. God wanted that recorded in the Bible for us to know today. And then there's a messianic prophecy right in the middle of Numbers 24, verse 17. "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob. A scepter shall rise out of Israel." Oh, who's that talking about? About Jesus, the Messiah. Mm-hmm. And now, all this time, was Israel as pure as the driven snow? No. Mm-mm. They were not restored. They were not restored. And a lot of times I will get comments from mostly leaders in the church that will say, "Well, we can't support Israel." And I'm not saying that this is all leaders. I'm not saying that at all. But we can't support Israel because Israel's in the land in unbelief. Or is the Israel today, here's another way of putting it, they'll say the Israel of today is not the Israel of the Bible. You know what? It's still the same Israel because they're not restored now. They weren't restored back then. They'll be restored at the end of the tribulation. Oh, but here in the midst of Balaam saying, "I know that it pleases God to bless Israel," in chapter 25 of Numbers, we read, "Now Israel went after harlotry." Okay? They prostituted themselves. They bowed down to other gods. And the anger of the Lord was aroused against them. And in Numbers 25:9, it says, "Those who died in that plague were 24,000. All right? So again, weeding out, that's still the first generation. And weeding out, because it's only the second generation that goes into the land of promise. And here's another verse, Deuteronomy 32, chapter 32, verses 9 to 10. Get a load of this. It says, "The Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the place of his inheritance." It's God's treasured possession. We find that in Deuteronomy 7. But then it says about God, "He found Israel in a desert place, in the wasteland, a howling wilderness, and God encircled Israel. He instructed Israel. He kept them as the apple of his eye," which means he protected them. The apple of the eye is the pupil. And you know how you protect your eyes, right? So God is protecting Israel, still protects Israel. And as an eagle stirs up its nest, verse 11 says of Deuteronomy 32, hovers over its young, spreading out its wings, taking them up, carrying them on its wings. So the Lord alone led Israel, and there was no foreign god with them. Isn't that amazing? So those are, I was going to say those are nuggets. There are a lot of verses like that. Even in the end of Deuteronomy 32, it says, rejoice, O Gentiles, with God's people, God's chosen people, Israel. And you know that Israel, God chose to accomplish his purposes, to make a covenant agreement with, to have on a short leash. They needed to obey. And if they didn't obey, food was withheld, water was withheld, rain was withheld. And so it wasn't a picnic meant all the time to have a covenant with God. But it's amazing. And he is guaranteeing, he has guaranteed their protection. And then it says, for he will avenge the blood of Israel and render vengeance to the enemies. And he will provide atonement for his land and his people. So I'm concluding that I would really like to have a conversation with somebody that says, well, this was, you know, not done because God rejected Israel at that time. Wouldn't that be good to have a conversation civilly, you know, and around the Word of God, obviously. Peggy?
Well, why do you think they weren't circumcised?
It says it. Okay, we're going to read it, all right? I don't know where we are.
I don't either.
Let me see. Okay, yeah. We'll read it right now, and then I'll go back. Look at, we're still on page 2. It's Joshua 5, 9. Then the Lord said to Joshua, this day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. Therefore, the name of the place is called Gilgal to this day. This was right after the circumcision. I have rolled away the reproach. Reproach meaning they were degraded, they were scorned, they were shamed because of having been in bondage to slavery in Egypt. And I think that's the reason, and I think, excuse me, that this coming into the land of promise is a fulfillment of, a partial fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. Abrahamic covenant promised them the land. They were in the land. They were in the land. So there's that fulfillment. And again, the sign of the Abrahamic covenant is covenant is circumcision. And so I really believe that that is the reason for it. But I'd have to go back and still refute what in my heart what's said about rejection of Israel. God chastened them a lot, don't you agree? And will continue to do so during the tribulation. The tribulation when there'll be a lot of Jewish people will be there. Many will be used, those 144,000 that are the evangelists. But as a nation, they'll be purged. It was you, Nan, right?
So you're saying that they had to wait for God to tell them to circumcise? To me, it was something
God.
Yeah.
Why didn't they do it on
their own? Why didn't they do it on their own? That's right.
But also, why didn't they have Passover all those times? Because they had the first Passover in Egypt, second Passover was at Mount Sinai, and then the third Passover was in the Land of Promise. So they didn't celebrate Passover through the wilderness as well. I still have many, many, many questions. I have many more questions than I have answers. But you know what? God says it. I believe it. That settles it for me. Isn't that a kiddo song?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So going back to, let me just see what I wanted to, I think we can move forward. Other than saying, I want us to go to Deuteronomy 4:4. Because when I think of the first generation all dying, and I think of the second generation dying, from what we've talked about over the weeks, what are your thoughts about the second generation? Anything specific? We don't read much about the desolation of the trek. And I didn't realize that because you got Exodus, right? You have Exodus, and they came out after the first Passover, and God tells them to build the tabernacle. They build the tabernacle, and the glory of God fills the tabernacle. Then you have God legislating from on top the mercy seat over the Ark of the Covenant and giving them the sacrifices and the laws. That's all through Leviticus. Then you have Numbers. And in Numbers, they move out. They depart from Sinai after being at Sinai for about 11 months, and they depart and they go up to Kadesh Barnea, and that's on your map too. Kadesh Barnea. It's right on the border, the southwestern border of the Promised Land. It's in purple. And do you see where it is, Kadesh Barnea? And they were going to hop right into the Promised Land, but of course that's when the 10 spies said, no, we can't, out of the 12 spies. But at that point, from that point in Numbers, and that's in Numbers 13, 14, they're in the wilderness. And you don't read all that much about the wilderness wanderings. Just check out Numbers, because then you also read about allotment of the land, the cities of refuge. There's not all that much, because someone had said, it might have been John MacArthur, because it was a time of waste, of desolation. And I understand what he's saying, but I think nothing's wasted in God's plan. And as that first generation, I mean, the second generation was being killed then. I was going to say a little out of time. I don't know that. There were carcasses all over. And they were killed, and the second generation saw this. And don't you think God was preparing them for entering into the Promised Land, the land of promise? So many lessons to be learned just through that trek across the wilderness. So when they get to the Jordan River, second generation goes in. That's a foreshadowing. And I never thought of it before this semester, a foreshadowing, because it's only, okay, we turn to Deuteronomy 4:4 if you have. Moses is telling the Jewish people, the second generation, he says, but you held fast to the Lord your God. I don't think I said that, but you who held fast to the Lord your God are alive today, every one of you. That second generation, they were faithful. They held fast to the Lord, and it was those who were faithful who went into the land of promise. Now, we do see spiraling downward, that's for sure, on the part of many, and more so from the book of Judges on. But where I'm going with that, they were faithful who got the land. At the end times, it's only going to be believers who go, I think I mentioned this last week, who go into the millennial kingdom. Jewish believers, Gentile believers. So those are the ones who are going to inherit the land. So this is, to me, is a foreshadowing of what is to come. Okay, so back to circumcision. I mean, they were probably hyped. They got circumcised. They were hyped to attack Jericho, but at a time like this, when they're healing, I've been told, I don't know who told me, I probably read it, that the third day is most painful. Oh, I know where I got it from. In Genesis 34, you read about the Shechemites all being circumcised, and Reuben and Levi, two of the sons of Jacob, killing them all on the third day. So I wanted to look up what the third day was about, and that's the most painful time. So they crossed the Jordan on the 10th day. They got circumcised. So we think of the 11th day, 12th, 13th day, and then maybe, and then on the 14th day, they celebrated Passover. But here all this time, they're under the noses of the Jerichoites. That's not how you say it, but the people of Jericho. And right in front of them, that was like a suicidal mission, don't you think? And directly in front of Jericho when they were circumcised. Directly in front of Jericho, and they were celebrating Passover. They were incapacitated for a while, and wow, that's a miracle of God. That's God's doing. Most definitely. So, and they were actually, by doing this, God, I had mentioned last week, God was conquering their hearts. They were put in a place that they could only trust God. How could they trust in themselves at this point? They could only trust God. And that's radical obedience. That's abandonment to ourselves, to God, not counting the cost, and knowing alone that He alone is worthy and He alone is able. So, going back to that, rolling away the reproach, Gilgal, the name of the place of lodging, means rolling. And look at, drop down on page, I think I'm still on page 2. Colossians, yeah, I am. Colossians 2:11 through and 13. This is about being born again, and that's considered a circumcision of the heart. In Him, in Jesus, you were also circumcised, with a circumcision made without hands, by putting off the body of the sins of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ. And you know, I was thinking of that in light of so many times we say in the Old Testament, well, we see what's physical. We see a physical deliverance, them coming out of Egypt, and that's going to look forward to our deliverance of being saved, being born again. But there were Old Testament saints in the Old Testament, in pre-cross. Everybody pre-cross, post-cross, us, has our heart, we have had our hearts circumcised. So it was looking forward to that. It was done at that time as well. Let me look at where I am. Okay. God's circumcision. Okay. Original Passover. All right. Circumcision. I am on page 3. And we know that circumcision of the heart before the cross and after the cross is based on what? Being born again, being saved, circumcised heart, is based on Jesus' work on the cross for us, His finished work on the cross. And I need to make, you might need to make a correction, or I'll correct it, because I corrected it with a comma, more of a comma, on my sheet. It's on page 3. Do you see where it says, after crossing the Jordan? And then it says on the 14th day of the month. When I read that the other day, and I had written it, you know, several weeks ago, I thought, what is that? They crossed the Jordan on the 10th day of the month. Well, I was alluding to what happened on the 14th day of the month. That's when they celebrated Passover. But it reads like I'm almost saying that they crossed on the 14th day of the month. So you might want to say, after crossing the Jordan, then on the 14th day of the first month, following the healing from the circumcision, the children of Israel celebrated, and they had Passover. Passover, okay. Do you think it was like the original Passover? Have you ever thought about that, how Passover was celebrated after that first Passover in Egypt? I thought about it for a time, and I thought, did they put the blood on the lintel over the door and the two doorposts? No, they didn't do that, but they definitely took a lamb and killed that lamb, and they remembered. God is big on telling the people to remember what He had done for them. And then look at Joshua 5:11 through 12. And they ate of the produce of the land on the day after Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain, not manna, because it ceased. Look at verse 12. Then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land. The children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. So God stopped the manna, because this was going to be a new trusting relationship between the children of Israel and God. And that's when they were able to observe the feasts that had to do especially with harvest. Was in the land, because they didn't have land to harvest while they were trekking across the desert. Now, I have arrows all over my paper, and I wanted to tell you why I said this. Oh, I know what it was. Okay. I didn't say it yet. Do you, especially as we go forward looking at the taking of Jericho, that's strange. Don't you think what God told Joshua to tell His people to do? Well, As I was thinking about that yesterday, I thought, I love the Christmas song. This is such a strange way to save the world. Have you ever heard of that? And I know I've mentioned it in classes before. I love it, you know, a virgin birth and God coming as a baby, being put in a manger. This is such a strange way to save the world. YouTube it. It's a wonderful song. It's a beautiful song. And I thought of my supervisor, Larry, who told this story, and some of you have heard it. He was attending, Larry Feldman, a good Irish name, right? And he was attending a bar mitzvah at a synagogue, and he went, and Larry is all about evangelism, and he was sitting next to the shamus. Shamus in the synagogue is the janitor. He's the helper. Shamus is a servant, okay? It's in the menorah, there's a shamus candle and it's a servant candle. Well, this janitor was sitting there, and of course Larry's telling him about Jesus. And so he finishes, and the shamus, the janitor said, yeah, you know, but that virgin birth stuff, I just don't get it. I don't get it. And Larry said, well, Abraham was beyond his fertile days, and Sarah was beyond childbearing, and Isaac was born. And the shamus said, it was a miracle. So it's good to share these things with people. And then more so than that, you could take it back to creation. God created out of nothing. God created out of nothing. So a virgin birth is so hard for God. And he gave conception. He gave conception to Sarah and to Rebecca and to Rachel, it says. They all had problems. So he gave conception to them. He promised two elderly people to make a great nation of them. Is that a strange way, right? Okay. These are miracles. They're all miracles. He parted the Red Sea. He dried up the Jordan River. He gave the second generation faith to go into the land of promise. He gave them his way of conquering Jericho. And you say, all that virgin birth stuff? No. No. Mm-mm. So don't, my advice to you is don't get verklempt when a Jewish person says, ay, that virgin birth stuff. Because we've had some people at Sierra Point say that too in years past. But be excited and say, you know what? I want to tell you about God from the Tanakh, from the Hebrew scriptures, and go through those passages. Really exciting. Okay. So let's see. Let's go to Joshua 5, 13 and 15, 13 through 15, in the middle of page 3. And it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries? And the man said, no. That's a very odd answer, but it really isn't. But as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? And it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho. So what was Joshua doing by Jericho? You know, God told Moses, take this land, take it, I have given it to you. And God told Joshua, every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given it to you. And they knew that Jericho would be the first battle, but there were no specifics given to the children of Israel. Even that reconnaissance mission by the two spies, that was a failure. They went to talk to Rahab. How glorious is that? So because Joshua had not been given a battle plan, maybe he went and looked around Jericho to devise a plan of attack. What do you think? Yeah. You think that's part of it? Okay, now think of this, because we got to think of how the Jewish people who had come across the Jericho, the second generation, all that they had seen, all that they had gone through, what were they remembering? God had performed for them, that he delivered them from Egypt, he parted the Red Sea, he dried up the Jordan River, And he had them circumcised. They were celebrating the Passover, and he protected them. But it says Joshua lifted his eyes, and I'm thinking that's a key right there, because he could have been lifting his eyes in prayer to God, don't you think? And while he's maybe studying the city of Jericho as well, but praying for God's deliverance. God had delivered that this whole way, and God was going to deliver now, and then this man comes along. But just a bit of history, I just have to tell you that sometime in the 2000 BC time frame, Jericho became the strongest Canaanite city. And we're told via some historical records that Egyptian and military campaigns told those people on the Mediterranean Sea, on the coast, to go towards the inland and fortify strong cities. And Jericho became a very fortified city. And it guarded the approach into the land of Canaan from the east. So that's why God said, go to especially Jericho. And I'm thinking too, as we said before, especially to see this Gentile prostitute, Rahab. So warfare, do you know what warfare looked like? In those days, warfare was either taken by assault. You surrounded the city. You know, you would rather you might have stoned. No, what do I want to say? You set the wall on fire of the city and went into the city, gaining entrance that way. Or you surrounded the city and then caused them to submit to you, caused them to surrender. But many times what would happen in that would take months, sometimes it would take years. And many times those attacking forces lost more people. So those attacking forces in this case would have been Israel. But the strategy to conquer Jericho was very unique in two ways. It was laid out by God, and it was a foolish plan, humanly speaking, right? So this man with a drawn sword, and Joshua went to him. Isn't that strange? Here this man is with a drawn sword out of its sheath, ready to strike, and Joshua moves toward him. And where did this man come from? He's in the same location as Joshua. Didn't Joshua see him? I mean, Joshua has desert smarts, doesn't he? But Joshua moves towards the man and says, basically, what he says is telling us that this man, Joshua is thinking, might be on the enemy's side. Yet Joshua walks toward the man. And how do we rectify that? God had been telling them, be strong and courageous. Be strong and courageous. So the man answering, no, no. Why is he answering Joshua that way? He's really saying, Joshua, you're not asking the right question. Are you for us or against us? You should be asking, on whose side are you, Joshua? I should be asking, on whose side are you, Joshua? Okay, are you on God's side or not on God's side? And the commander of the army, the Lord of hosts, some translations state, is Lord, L-O-R-D, capitalized, means Yahweh. And Zabaoth means Zabaoth, more Englishly, and it's a reference to the angelic armies. This man is the commander of the angelic armies. And who is this man? It's Jesus. It's a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus. And I'm going to fast forward through my notes because I do see time is fleeting. And what was Joshua's response to the man? He fell on his face to the earth. And the man didn't say, no, 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 you can't worship me, get up. No, because this man is God, this man is Jesus. And he worshiped him. And then he said, what does my Lord say to his servant? And the commander of the Lord's army said, take your sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy. Is that not evidence that this is God? Yes. And so I do believe that this man gives Joshua the instructions regarding taking Jericho. Look at page 5, Joshua 6, 1 to 2. Oh, and I wanted to mention, because I wrote this down in my notes, I don't know if it's on yours. Why is it odd to have a pre-incarnate appearance of the Messiah? Some might say it's odd. I don't think it's odd. Jesus existed before he came to Bethlehem at his incarnation. He's eternal. Okay, so now this is what we're going to read about the military strategy. And the man even says in verse 2 of Joshua 6, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king and the mighty men of valor," because they're completely shut up. No one's going out, no one's coming in. So they had to be dispossessed of their lands. Interesting, God said in Deuteronomy 9, go in and get rid of these people who are wicked. They have reached the pinnacle of wickedness. And so they had to be vacated from their premises. So here's the battle plan, Joshua 6:3-5. "You shall march around the city, all you men of war. You shall go all around the city once. This you shall do 6 days, and seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the seventh day you shall march around the city seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. It shall come to pass when they make a long blast with a ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout with a great shout. Then the wall of the city will fall down flat." Do you think that the people, when Joshua said, well, you know, God told me this is what we must do, and he explained it, do you think the people said, what are you, crazy? But no, I really think that they had seen so much by that time that they were gung-ho. That's how God had prepared them. I really believe that. And so any questions about that strategy before we just go a little further?
I don't know if I'm jumping ahead, but so when this is happening, I'm like, wow, why are the people from Jericho like zinging their arrows and throwing fire at them? Because typically that's what would happen in a war like that. But then it says their hearts had been melted.
Yeah.
They were full of fear.
They had lost all confidence.
Yeah. And they're like, well, they're just marching. We're going to leave them be for now. You know?
They probably wondered, now what are we going to see? Exactly. Something more? I was going to say awesome, miraculous. Yes, we were going to see that, but more terrifying in their eyes. Yeah,
that's
Wendy.
A good question.
Shaking in the good
ones. Yes.
Another just real quick support for that being Jesus instead of an angel is in Revelation. Mm-hmm. John goes to bow twice, and the angel says, "No, no, no.
Yeah.
I'm just So that was because I was kind of questioning that a little bit, and then I remembered that, and I thought, okay, that's confirmation.
Yeah, because he was bound to an angel, definitely. And when it says the angel of the Lord, angel means messenger or one with a message, and Jesus has a message. He is the Word of God. He has a message. So, you know what? It says, I'm going to find it in my little notes. It does tell us that when they went around the city, look at Joshua 6:10. When the men went around the city, God says, "You shall not shout." This is, you know, the first time. And they went one time around every day for 6 days. And then on the seventh day, they went around seven times. And Joshua 6:10 says, "You shall not shout or make any noise with your voice, nor shall a word proceed out of your mouth." That's terrifying in and of itself from a warrior standpoint. And also, what were they thinking? I think God said this. This is my thought regarding it, so that they would reflect on all that had happened, what God was going to do now, and in prayer time before God. But time of reflection for submission, definitely. And when I said it would be more terrifying, again, a silent army that can be seen by the enemy, they were probably tearing out their hair in Jericho. What is going on? Okay. So lessons. And of course it says in Joshua 6:16 that when the people of God by faith followed all the commands of God, that the walls of Jericho fell flat. That's actually in verse 20 in Joshua 6.